a roundup of the main business news from China and elsewhere. This is Global Business.
From CGTN headquarters here in Beijing, this is Global Business. I'm Michael Wong. The headlines we're tracking at this hour. The future of Beijing. The Chinese capital outlines the road ahead to drive innovation and growth as it pursues high-quality development. Negative no more. Japan's central bank ends its negative interest rate policy and raises benchmark rates for the first time in 17 years. And agriculture technology. We take a closer look at how China is advancing technology in its countryside to boost farming's efficiency and rural productivity. And we start right here in the Chinese capital, where Beijing is leveraging its strategic significance as the national capital and embracing a new era of innovation and growth, said the mayor at a press conference earlier today. CGTN's Dai Kai-yi has more.
Beijing is making solid strides in high-quality development. Last year, the city's GDP grew by 5.2%, reaching a total of 4.4 trillion yuan. The mayor of Beijing, Yin Yong, emphasized the city's commitment to integrate into the new development paradigm. He highlighted Beijing's positioning in technological innovation.
Focus will be on strengthening the construction of an international science and technology innovation center, leveraging Beijing's advantages in developing new quality productive forces. We will coordinate educational and technological talent resources, cultivate various scientific and technological forces, and continue to implement forward-looking strategies such as leading actions in basic research and tackling key core technologies.
The mayor also spoke about accelerating the progress of landmark projects such as integrated circuits, new energy vehicles, and biomanufacturing. He emphasized solidifying and expanding Beijing's leading edge in industries like artificial intelligence and advanced autonomous driving, with a focus on building the city into a global benchmark for digital economy.
During the press conference, officials also discussed plans to consolidate and enhance improvements in air quality, actively promote carbon peaking and neutrality, and further expand Chinese capital's march towards reforms and opening up. They also emphasized the need to improve people's livelihoods, especially in healthcare and housing. Dai Kai-yi, CGTN, Beijing.
For more on Beijing's high-quality development, I want to bring in Professor Liu Baocheng, Dean of the Center for International Business Ethics at the University of International Business and Economics. Professor Liu, thanks for joining us. So, look, a center for advanced technology, that may not be the first thing that comes to our mind, at least for international viewers, when they think about Beijing. But according to Beijing's mayor earlier today, we've got over 40% of China's AI talent residing here in this city. And Beijing has one of the world's highest R&D intensity levels at around 6% of GDP. So what's your take on Beijing's efforts to become this world-leading tech and innovation hub?
Well, Beijing is almost equipped with every condition for inner-driven economy and also for city management. And for example, we have nearly 100 high learning institutions which continually to provide a talent pool for research and also for application and technological improvements. And then we also have very powerful the research academies. And now take, for example, the Academy of Science has more than 100 the research organizations that are continuing to feed both in terms of the fundamental research and also the application on the business part. Then the Beijing provides also more of the enabling environment for multinationals to come here. For example, now we have nearly 50,000 foreign companies, and out of which nearly 100 the multinationals, they build research centers in Beijing, which collaborates with the local research power and also research talents. So that can really help to boost the continuous drive for innovation in the major framework of high-quality development in Beijing.
Yeah, and you spoke about the research talent base here in Beijing, Professor. I mean, earlier policymakers were saying in terms of the talent pool ecosystem, we've got about 550,000 scientific research personnel right here in Beijing. So it's a huge talent base to push innovation forward. But also from building more international schools to building more international hospitals to one-stop super apps that can provide a ton of city services at your fingertips. Policymakers also spoke about making the Chinese capital even more welcoming for international businesses, for foreigners who want to work, live or travel to Beijing. So what is the sense you're getting in terms of this city's commitment to welcoming people from all around the world? And what more needs to be done, you think?
I was part of the advisor to how Beijing can shape itself as a more of international friendly metropolitan to the world. And I raised a very common sense issues that are for anyone city that is able to be helping the foreign visitors and foreign business people, it has to be stranger friendly. So therefore, Beijing has been cleaning up the street and also putting more of the bilingual signs. And then more of the people, not only in the research organizations or universities over Beijing, they, from taxi drivers to chefs in the restaurant, they're able to speak some of the foreign language, which is very important. And also the for foreign businesses to be attracted to Beijing, the cheaper but professional labor force is a critical factor that is there to provide sustainable profit rate for foreign companies. And then the a supply chain, which is able to help to streamline some of the custom procedures, inspection issues, and bonded warehouse. And now Beijing also as the hub for international logistics can also give added impetus for foreign companies to park here.
Yeah. Okay. Professor Liu, many thanks for your thoughts on that. Stay with us. We're going to come back to you in just a second. Well, located just an hour's drive away from the bustling financial hub of Shanghai lies Taicang, which is a quaint small city known as China's Germantown. Taicang, over the past few decades, has become a magnet for numerous German companies and substantial investments. Our Chen Tong travels to the city to find out more.
We are here in Taicang at the point of the origin of the number 103 bus line. Check out the stop sign here. Well, if you know Chinese, most of these signs are actually transliteration of German terms.
The route runs through Eastern Nanjing Road, an industrial cluster for the automobile industry. Our stop is called Kurt Liebers, the first German firm that came to Taicang.
Guten Tag.
Ni hao, and welcome to Kurt Liebers.
In 1993, the German manufacturer of car parts decided to set up a firm in China. He chose Taicang because of the location.
Very close to the big cities, to the big hubs, port, airports, Shanghai. We liked it.
Taicang has a population of only 850,000 people. But it's only a one-hour drive from central Shanghai and sits along the Yangtze River.
In the beginning, I think Kurt Liebers did a lot of advertising for Taicang. So companies like Fischer or Mubea came in because we recommended it. Now I also do that.
In the 1990s, there were only a dozen German firms in Taicang, but this figure jumped significantly in the 2000s. But geography is not the only reason 500 firms have set up shop here. One man, Duan Yueqiang, has played a key role. Over the past 20 years, Duan has traveled to Germany at least once a year, only to attract more German investment.
First, they require high-end technologies. Second, they require high-quality professionals who understand how to operate high-end machine tools and possess foreign language proficiency to understand these drawings.
To help the firms find the employees they want, Taicang has even imported a German education system called the Dual System. This is the training center at a German firm. Students spend a part of their time at a local vocational school to develop their theoretical knowledge, and the rest of the time they spend here learning the practicalities of the job. Taicang currently has over 20 such training centers. The system also provides job opportunities to locals. 60% of jobs in Taicang are provided by German firms. Based in Taicang for more than three decades, the very first German firm in the city is still growing.
The industrial chain also especially over the last decade become more and more convenient, better and better. And not only if you look at, let's say, the factory suppliers or customers of us, but also the infrastructure. You have more and more schools, you have very big university now.
For Duan Yueqiang, traveling to Germany is still part of his annual agenda.
I introduce our business environment and answer their questions about the Chinese market.
When the first German firm came to Taicang 30 years ago, this little county could probably never imagine one day it will become a home for German firms in China. And they keep coming. While some people are saying foreign investors are quitting China, I think what's happening in Taicang proves how wrong they are. Chen Tong, CGTN Taicang, Jiangsu Province.
Meanwhile, IKEA owner Inka Group's retail manager Togo Onsu said the Swedish company is planning to invest some 6.3 billion yuan over the next 3 years here in China. Speaking of his outlook on the Chinese consumer market, he's still confident in the offline physical retail market in this country amid the thriving online economy.
Have you witnessed any changes in spending patterns and any distinctive trends from Chinese consumers?
I personally think one of the big topics and big trends now is the focus on fulfillment and the last mile capabilities and how important it will be to have sustainable. So in Shanghai, for instance, was the first city in IKEA world where we have 100% of our home deliveries are done through EV trucks. And already in whole China, we are at 93%, which is the highest number we have.
What does the China market mean to your global retail business?
I mean, it means a lot. It is the second biggest home furnishing market in the world. We have been here for many, many decades, and we're also planning to continue since we are not reaching the many Chinese today, so we still have a lot of homework to do. To accelerate that, we are now investing in the coming 3 years 6.3 billion RMB to continue freshening up the stores we already have, but also looking into opportunities to become more relevant and convenient through our digital channels, but also opening new formats. So we have an opening in Xi'an coming, and then we have here in Shanghai in Lincoln, and then in Shenzhen we will be opening the first ever plan and order point in China.
So does that mean you are still confident in the offline physical retail market in China amid such thriving online economy?
Absolutely. Digitally we are accessible to everyone everywhere, but physically when people want to ask some questions, sit down and do a kitchen planning or a bedroom planning, so then we see this as a fantastic opportunity to be more relevant. Every time we come to China, it's like traveling into the future, where we see a lot of competence in China that is much faster, much more advanced. And this is also one of the reasons why we're spending now 2 weeks in Asia. But most of these 2 weeks here in China is actually to learn and understand, and how can we take that and go back to Europe and become even better retailer in Europe.
What new retail formats are you looking for in China currently?
Most of them, of course, being a bit smaller. For us, small, but for many other companies, this would still be very big shops. And there we are very excited for the development that is happening both in China, but also across the world, to find new ways to actually interact with customers, be closer. If you just want to take 15 minutes walk to continue your planning session for your next bedroom.
So you will be opening small stores that are closer to people's residential compounds?
Could be. That's what we are exploring to see, especially when it comes to the areas where there is a lot of interest in renovations in people's homes, or when people change life situation, going from being a couple to having a child. There is big change in their homes. So how can we be close to when people need the support and there is still a big potential where our stores are not going to be enough?
The world economy as we know it is about to change. Global business reports highlight emerging markets, developing countries, and dynamic sectors worldwide. We feature top analysts and newsmakers to provide perspectives on every facet of business. From an on-the-ground perspective, we provide you with balanced and objective assessments. Fast, sharp, and insightful. Global Business. Only on CGTN.
For more on the Bank of Japan's policy shift, I want to cross over now to Chris Gilbert in Tokyo. Hi there, Chris. So after 17 years, why does the Bank of Japan believe now is the right time to overhaul policy, and are businesses concerned?
Yeah, well, I just was speaking to an economist not 10 minutes ago who kept emphasizing to me what a big change this is. It's such a little change in some ways. If you look at the details, from negative 0.1 to 0 to 0.1% interest rate hikes, but structurally and almost metaphorically the symbolism of it is very significant, considering how hands off, how hawkish the bank has been. And economists are telling me it is yet to be seen the full impact of this, whether this big change, as they say, is going to have an impact that the markets and the businesses here find favorable, or if they end up finding that it is quite hawkish and more pressure remains on the bank. But this is coming from conditions that the bank has been trying to foster. They've been waiting for real wages to outpace inflation, and we've just had a bumper, we're still in the middle of a bumper wage negotiation season here between unions and employers here in Japan, with a lot of major companies like Nissan, Mazda, Japan Airlines, Toyota, all agreeing to have record pay hikes, and Rengo, the major union here, realizing their goal of 5% or higher real wage growth for their members. And so the bank says that it now believes that the conditions are correct for the Japanese economy to grow without as much stimulus. And this was a point that Governor Ueda stressed, was that they do not necessarily want to choke the supply of money in the economy. They just want to reduce the amount of stimulus, and that the economy, after dragging its heels somewhat in terms of activity and uptick after the long years of the pandemic, is finally in a position to do so. He has repeated, however, that it wants to remain accommodative to businesses. They don't want to spook the horses just yet. And other economists have also been telling me that from here, they are expecting a cycle of interest cuts to come up in other parts of the world and economies in the United States and in Europe. And so they do not expect any further hikes from the Bank of Japan from here at this stage, because that will cut against the grain of that trend and potentially negatively impact exchange rates. So all eyes are on the next moves, but for now, it's certainly a very significant monetary policy shift.
All right, Chris, many thanks for that report. Chris Gilbert for us in Tokyo on the Bank of Japan finally ending its negative interest rate policy. Well, back here in China, farmers across various regions have begun spring plowing as temperatures begin to rise. And to enhance efficiency, farmers are now benefiting from advanced technologies, including unmanned machines. And these technological advancements are proving to be invaluable when it comes to increasing the effectiveness of plowing operations. Our Zhu Zhu has more.
We are now here at a farm in southern China's Guangdong province. It's turning around. I don't need to do anything.
I'm just showing you guys how this works.
We don't need any human laborers here because someone else is doing the remote control.
First, we drive this machine to the field and mark 4 points. Then we can get off and operate it using the remote control. This unmanned rice transplanter can plant about half the area of a soccer field per hour. It can work for as long as you need it to. Now, with the help of unmanned driving machines, we don't tire out as easily. In the past, regardless of wind or rain, we had to go down to the fields to cultivate crops.
Growing seedlings is essential for spring farming because it affects how much rice farmers can harvest and how good it is. Using machines to grow seedlings ensures they are planted at the right density.
In the past, the work that required 20 people can now be done by just 2 or 3 people. What's more, unmanned machines ensures that the density of rice planting is consistent, better than our manual planting.
They also have unmanned vehicles that can help them spray fertilizer evenly.
So far, this unmanned plowing model has already been promoted in 13 provinces across China, greatly advancing China's process of agricultural modernization. Those farmers I talked to all told me that they were very happy that these technologies have saved them a lot of time and effort and leave them more time to focus on more important tasks and teach and train more farmers to use these technologies to increase efficiency.
我们全区有8.5万台这个农业机械。
We have 85,000 agricultural machines in our entire district, and the mechanization level of crop cultivation exceeds 90%.
Farmers who lack sufficient funds to purchase these equipment can apply for agricultural loan support online.
上个月吧，上个月的赤泥镇，就花都赤泥镇那边呢，我们是有给那个
Last month, we distributed agricultural loans to farmers in Chini Town to expand their planting areas. Their profit increased by about 10%.
The International Federation of Robotics predicts that by 2025, the global agricultural robot market is expected to reach $10 billion, with the Chinese market emerging as the largest growth point. International investors are optimistic about China's digital agriculture prospects.
They are now, through digital tools, able to connect to farmers by 12,000 mu. So their ability to have one person connect to 12,000 mu worth of farming today, whereas 5 years ago it was only 1,000 mu. 5 years from now, it'll be 20,000 mu. So that's just the power of digital.
This year's government work report reiterated the importance of advancing agricultural modernization. As outlined in the country's 14th five-year plan for the development of national agricultural mechanization, the goal is to achieve a mechanization rate of 75% for crop cultivation and harvest by next year. Zhuzhou, CGTN, Guangzhou in Guangdong Province.
Right, so let's get more on technology's role in China's agriculture sector and bring back Professor Liu Baocheng from the University of International Business and Economics. So, Professor Liu, as we just saw from that previous report, effective agriculture technology used in the right circumstances, that can definitely boost crop yields and it can boost labor productivity in China's countryside. How are policymakers at the central level and officials at the local level working to ensure that this ag tech really gets to the hardest to reach places in China's rural areas?
Well, this is really a transformative move because for several thousand years, Chinese people has been sweating in the land for plowing, driving cows. Actually, when I was a child, I was doing the job, you know, leading the cows to plow the field, and that was highly laborious and even damaged to health. Now we can see that the application of modern technology and modern equipment, all the machineries, particularly led by the digitization process, is really there to usher in a revolutionary change in the Chinese agricultural work. And that is something that can give the Chinese a great perspective in the green security and also in the quality of the Chinese agriculture, and more importantly, it is really the scientific use of fertilizer and or seasoning, seeding banks, building, and this way it can turn out to be more cost effective. But I think now this is just a precursor, and more is really to be mainstreamed to roll out across the country in teaming more of the technologies into a bigger scale so that more of the farmland can really benefit from that.
Well, Professor Liu, it's always a daunting task. It's always a big challenge when it comes to feeding a population of over 1.4 billion people. So how does China think about what agriculture technology means for ensuring food security for so many people?
Well, I think now the Chinese agriculture has been the basis for the food security over here. One is that the government is still maintaining a very tough red line to have enough arable land that is there to serve the basis for the crop production. And the other is trying to boost the productivity per acres of land. So I think now you see that the modernization in the Chinese agriculture is something that is there a sure way to boost the productivity. And now the household responsibility system invigorated the Chinese enthusiasm to work harder, but with the introduction of new technologies, and we need to really to build more skill instead of allowing farmers to work on small pieces of land. And the other is, it doesn't mean that China will be totally reliant on itself, because comparative advantage with the rest of the world in terms of food security is also very important. For example, we continue to import soybeans and some maize to serve either the animal feedstuff or to put it into other industrial use. So this way, we are able to get more of the advantage by trading with other nations while we keep the main, the staple food firmly in our hands.
All right, Professor Liu, many thanks for your thoughts on all of that. Professor Liu Baocheng, Dean at the Center for International Business Ethics at UIBE. Thank you, as always. And in other headlines we're tracking at this hour, in Australia, the central bank decided to keep key interest rates unchanged at a 12-year high of 4.35% on Tuesday. The decision reflects the growing confidence of the Reserve Bank of Australia that its policies are gaining traction and effectively curbing inflation. NVIDIA launched its latest chip on Monday. The new chip offers an impressive performance boost with speeds up to 30 times faster than its predecessor for specific tasks. Meanwhile, the Bank for International Settlements has issued a warning about the global economy. While acknowledging that major economies are on track for a soft landing, the BIS cautions that inflation has not yet been fully subdued. And this warning comes as global policymakers engage in debates about the merits of reducing interest rates from multi-decade highs. And with that, we're going to wrap up this edition of Global Business here on CGTN. I'm Michael Wong here in Beijing. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you again next time.